Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is Perek Chaf Tet of Sefer Yechezkel, chapter 29 of the book of Yechezkel. Bashana Asirid Asiri B'Shnei Masar LaChodesh Hayadra Hashem Elai Lemor. In the 10th year, in the 10th month, on the 12th of the month, the word of Hashem came to me saying. So the Radak points out that this is counting by the kingdom of Titkiyahu. And that means that the nevuah for Tzor, which came earlier in the book, happened later because it happened in the 11th year. But the nevuah about Mitzrayim came first, and then, so that even though the nevuah came first, they put the nevuah about Tzor in there. They put the nevuah about Tzor in there first, and then in the year of the destruction, he had the nevuah about Mitzrayim twice, and then two more after the destruction. So Mitzrayim becomes sort of a focus in the time of the destruction, which is interesting because Mitzrayim had very little other than abandoning the Jewish people and not helping them out when Nebuchadnezzar was besieging them and then destroying them. Mitzrayim isn't so relevant, and yet they become the focus of Yechezkel's nevuah attention in this time period. Pasuk bet ben adam sim panech al paro melech Mitzrayim yinave alav ve'al Mitzrayim kula. So it says, turn your face toward Paro and towards Egypt and give a nevuah for it. Daber ve'amar dekol amar Hashem Elokim hini alech al paro melech Mitzrayim hatanim hagadol harovetz betoch ye'orav asher amar li ye'ori v'ani asitini. So earlier we had seen that Tzor has its own take on its power and its what makes it great and it being too taken with itself, and that was a problem for Tzor. Here too, we're going to have a similar thing in the case of Egypt, in that they turn to their river, to their Nile, as the center of their power. So similar to what we had a metaphor of Tzor as being a ship, Rashi points out here we have a metaphor of Egypt as being a tanim hagadol, as being a sea monster, as being something that lives in the sea, and the people are going to be the fish of the Nile because they point to the sea, to the river, to the Nile as everything. The Radak points out that they therefore think they don't need water or rain, which is why they are so taken with themselves. So it's another example of being overly self-confident and thinking that you have self-sufficiency without needing Hashem. So that's what he says, li yori, and then ani asitini. The question is, does ani asitini mean literally, I think I made it in some way? So Rashi goes in that direction, that I literally made it, but that with my wisdom and my strength and my power, I made it bigger, and I based on that, expanded my empire. Which is how the Radak sees it too. So in other words, it's not the fundamental yor was there naturally. But they take credit and they take in their assumption that they, by their wisdom and by their insight, had expanded and improved it, and that was what led to their power.
Natati chachim b'chayecha v'hidbakti digat yorecha b'kas kesotecha v'alitricha mitoch yorecha v'ekol digat yorecha b'kas kesotecha tidbak. So Hashem says, I'll put chachim in your cheeks or in your jaws. So chachim, the JPS English just puts in hooks in your jaws, but which is perfectly accurate. But I believe the Dat Mikra points out that chachim are the kinds of nose rings or things that you put in to lead animals to do your bidding and do your will. So if the tanim is not a fish so much as a monster, a sea creature of some sort, then the chachim are a way for Hashem to say, I mean, we're going to lead you by the leash, by the nose ring, by the tool here, and then all of the Digat Yorecha, which is sort of your citizens, are going to be attached to you and stuck to you. So they'll follow their leaders, and the leader will have to become docile and subservient to Hashem. And I'm going to take you, Hashem says, Unitashtich Hamidbara Utcha v'kol Digat Yorecha, you and all your people, all of the fish of the Yor, al pnei ha'sadeh tipol, you'll fall in the fields, lo te'aseh, lo tikabeis, you won't be gathered, you won't be taken in, l'chayat ha'aretz lo v'ashamayim, netaticha le'ochla, you'll become food for everybody. For the animals of the fields, for the birds of the land, for the birds of the sky. So instead of being powerful as you had fancied yourself to be, you will be turned into open season, open prey for everybody else. V'yad'u kol yoshvei Mitzrayim kini Hashem yan heyotam mish'enet kaneh Levet Yisrael, and everybody will know, all the Mitzrayim will know that I am Hashem, and the reason they're getting this punishment, so again, the connection that Yecheskel draws between punishment and learning that Hashem is truly the God of the universe is a striking one, and one we have to keep in mind, that Hashem understands it, the Nevuah understands it, that experiencing these kinds of punishments will be something that will finally prove Hashem's power to other nations, and the source of these punishments, why they're getting all of this, is there having been a mishenet kaneh, a bad read. In other words, that part of what led the Jews astray. So we'll remember that in Yechezkel's time, Yechezkel was hoping for, and certainly Yirmiyahu was hoping for, that the Jews would surrender to Nebuchadnezzar. They would just realize that Hashem did not want them to fight, and that by surrendering, they would be recognizing that their sins had led them to a point they needed to lose their independence for a while, to be subservient to Nebuchadnezzar. And then if they managed to maintain some kind of a proper relation with Hashem, that would all turn around eventually, but they had to learn that. So part of what led them to continue fighting was their belief that Egypt would come to help them. And so Egypt's failure to help them is something that Egypt is blamed for. Of course, if Egypt had come to help them, that would have ruined the plan in other ways, but that's not Egypt's choice to make. So what happened was when they tried to grab you, you would splinter, meaning and leaving splinters in their hands, and you would wound their shoulders because if they tried to lean on you and you broke and you fell, they would hurt their shoulders, and then it would make them unable to stand and unable to be supported. So that is what Mitzrayim is being blamed for, and that is what is going to lead to their downfall. So pasuk chet l'chein kol marashem elokim li mevi alayech charev. I'm going to bring the sword upon you. V'yichareti mimeich adam uvehima. And so the sword, meaning a conquering agent, will come, and then the land of Egypt will be emptied of people and animals. It'll be desolate and wasteland. That recurring refrain we've seen in all these chapters. And the connection is very strong and very clear. Their believing that their strength, that their Yor would hold them up, is what's going to lead to this needing to happen. From their various borders, from Sevene into Kush, they're going to be completely desolate. Nobody will walk through it. And animals won't wander through it. For 40 years, it will not be resettled. So it's a prediction of complete desolation of the land of Egypt. Now, one of our traditions is that this desolation, so there's debate about whether there's debate in the Gemara. No, there's a debate in the Rishonim. The Baalei Tosfos point out that Rabbi Akiva was of the opinion that anybody who nowadays is an Egyptian does not have the rules of a Mitzri in the Torah. The Torah says a Mitzri can't come into Kahal Hashem until the third generation. And Rabbi Akiva says it doesn't have to do, that's not relevant today because Ashur came and, or Nebuchadnezzar came, Sancheiriv, the king of Ashur, came and mixed up all of the nations, and so therefore they weren't there. So if Rabbi Akiva was right, Yechezkel's Nevuah is somewhat too late, but Bahag thinks that's not true. The Bahag thinks that, no, we paskin that the Egyptians in that time returned to their place, and he points to our pasuk of those Yishev Arbim Shana that will be empty for 40 years as proof that at the end of the 40 years we're going to find another pasuk that will say, Miketz Arbim Shana, and they'll come back. So pasuk Yud Vav, and the 30th time Shemama betoch aratzot neshamon, areha betoch arim macharav much. I'll spread them among all the nations. They'll be exiled and they'll be kicked off their land. Then pasuk so that's the pasuk the Bahag points to. At the end of 40 years, Hashem will gather them back. So, but this is a prediction that's made in time Yechezkel close to the Churban Bayit. So that's way after Sancheiriv. So the connection between those two nevuot is odd. And when those 40 years would happen is something that would be unclear in the Pesukim. And you can easily imagine somebody saying, no, there's a view about the future of some point. And the question is whether 40 years would be meant literally in any case, because 40 years is a strong metaphorical time. Right? The Jews spent 40 years in the desert after they failed at the Chet HaMeraglim, after they failed to properly understand what Hashem wanted for them, so they had to spend 40 years in the desert. 40 years is a standard, could be seen as a standard re-educational period. So that could be what we're talking about here. And when those 40 years would happen, it's not necessarily clear. So, but the Navi says, Pasuk Yudalet, Veshavti et Shevut Mitzrayim, Vashivoti otam eretz patros, al eretz mechurotam, Vayusha mamlacha shfala. They'll return. So as we haven't seen before, necessarily, that there will be a promise of return for the nations that Hashem is going to lead to punishing. But here they are going to be returned, but they're going to be a mamlacha shfala, a lowly kingdom. So Pasuk Tedvav goes on with that. Min hamamlachot tia shfala, they're going to be the lowest of all of the kingdoms, and they're no longer going to raise themselves, lift themselves up over other nations, and I will make them lesser so that they don't rule over other nations. So when exactly that will or not come true is not clear in the Navi, but it's also worth wondering why would that need to be true? Why would it be that the Navi would, why would it be that Hashem would say, that the Navi would say that they will no longer be able to ever have rule again? So here it's not necessarily clear. The Pasuk doesn't quite tell us. So Pasuk Tedvav, Tedzayin, I'm sorry, goes on and gives some explanation. Lo ye'od levet yisol miftach mazkir avon, viftotam achareihem, viyadu kini Hashem Elokim. So one possibility is that they're just too dangerous. That the Jews, and then, I mean, you'd have to ask why the Egyptians have to suffer the Jews' lack of faith, but it would be that the Pasuk seems to say that the Jews are so caught up with turning to Mitzrayim for help that Hashem says they will never again be strong enough to offer any of that kind of help, so as to avoid the Jews coming to think that Mitzrayim would be a valid and valuable source of assistance for them. So if that's true, it sounds like Mitzrayim might have changed their ways, and yet they still need to suffer. So I suspect that it's not the whole story, and that part of what's going on is that Mitzrayim, having set itself up as the Navi says here, Hatanim Agadol, a big, great beast that has power and sees itself as having power and is aware of its power, so that because of that, and because of that aspect of Mitzrayim's persona, of Mitzrayim's experience of itself, that they therefore lost some of their right to full independence, and that it's a lasting kind of a thing. So we live in a world, or a Jewish world, of tshuva, where things are forgiven and where we have the ability to secure forgiveness for almost anything that we do wrong. So in such a world, we can't imagine why it would be that they couldn't just go off to the desert for their 40 years, which would be suffering, and they would have suffered, and they would have taken their punishment, and they would have accepted their punishment, and they would have grown from it. So when they come back, everything should just go back to being as it was. So I wonder if here we don't have an example of the suggestion that it doesn't always work like that, that they will come back, in contrast to other nations, which perhaps never will come back, will never have a mamlacha again. So Mitzrayim is enough part of Hashem's picture of the world that they will come back and they will have a mamlacha once again, but that mamlacha will always have to be shfala, they'll always have to be lowly. And I wonder about this in another context too. It's similar to, it might be similar to, how we deal with Amalek, meaning that we often tend to think that the commandment was you have to destroy Amalek no matter what. But as the Rambam points out, it's not quite true. So it's a debate between the Rambam and the Ravid. The Ravid thinks that in order for Amalek to be allowed to survive, they have to convert to Judaism. If that's true, then whatever their sin was in the time of the Midbar, in the times of the Jews being in the desert, what it turns out is that they had sinned so grievously that Hashem said there cannot be a nation called Amalek anymore. And so anybody who still sticks to the identity of Amalek will necessarily have to be removed from the world. So if that's what happened, that's what happened. But the Rambam suggests that it's not exactly right, that anybody from Amalek who agrees, now he has a couple of conditions, and this is true for the seven Canaanite nations as well. Anybody from Amalek who agrees to observe the seven mitzvot that any Ben Noah, that any non-Jew is required to observe, that's condition number one. Condition number two is that they have to agree to be permanently subservient to the Jewish people in various ways. They have to pay tribute, and they have to agree to physical service, pay a tax of their physical time to do service to the Jewish people. So the question, why would we insist on that? So part of the reason might be that in doing that, they all the time continue to declare their acknowledgement that the Jews are in fact the nation of Hashem and that their worldview is the correct worldview. So if you take that idea in the Rambam as being true for what he said in Amalek. That's the explanation for what he thought about Amalek and what he thought about the Shevet Amimina, that the need to destroy was not so much a need to destroy as a need to destroy a worldview and a perspective, and that as long as the members of that nation were willing to abandon that worldview and continually abandon that worldview throughout their lives by living lives in which they pay some kind of financial tribute and which they do some kind of physical service, not slavery, it's just the willingness to do service, and that willingness to do service demonstrates their acceptance of the Jewish worldview. So if that's true, then here too, the declaration that Mitzrayim will have to be a mamlacha shfala, will have to be a lowly kingdom, could be something along those lines as well. They get their kingdom back, they get their land back, they are re-educated, but they have to be lowly, first of all, to protect the Jews or help the Jews not make the same error again, but also maybe for themselves as well, to make sure that they, throughout the rest of history, live their lives in an expression of their acceptance of Hashem's view of the world. Pasuk Yud Zayin, Vayhi Be'asvim Vasheva Shana Barishon Ve'achad Lachodesh, Hayad Hashem Elai Le'mor. Now for what seems like, and there's a Parashat Petucha here, so it might just be a completely new topic, but it's not clear necessarily that it's a new topic. In the 27th year, in the first month, in the first of the month, so the 27th year of the 27th year, Rashi says, of the kingdom of Nebuchadnezzar. And that was the year that Mitzrayim is going to be conquered by him. And then Rashi says in, that the book isn't so careful about Mugdam and Mu'uchar, but it's striking that we switch our standard of measurement of time. Right? All of a sudden, the 27th year of Nebuchadnezzar, why wouldn't we just talk about whatever year it was of Tzidkiyahu or whatever year it was of whatever events it was? Or the count of the years when of his being exiled to Babel, of Yechezkel going to into exile. So we'll see that in a second. So Pasuk Yechet, Ben Adam Nebuchadnezzar, Melech Babel ha'evid et chelo avodah gdola el tzor. He did great work. He made his army work hard to go to Tzor, called Rosh Mukrach, V'chol Katef Meruta, and they're working so hard that their heads are rubbed without tooth, so they don't have hair, and their shoulders are scraped. V'zachar lo hayalo l'chelo mitzor al avodah sh'ervana, and he has not yet been given any kind of real reward of Hashem's reward for all the hard work he did in conquering Tzor, where he was serving as the messenger of Hashem. L'chein komer Hashem Elokim, heini noten Nebuchadnezzar melech Babel eretzayim v'nasah hamona v'shalal shlalach v'azab bizach v'ayta sechar l'chelo. So he was going to get all of Egypt as a reward. So why it was that Tzor wasn't a reward is not so clear in the Pesachim, right? Why? Tzor was a merchandising city. It was the center of commerce, as we saw in the Nevuot. So apparently it wasn't seen as being enough of a reward by the time, perhaps by the time that he conquered it. So therefore he's going to conquer all of Egypt and he's going to get its booty and its spoils of war, and that will be for him and all of his armies a sufficient reward. Pu'ulato asher avad ba natati lo Mitzrayim, in reward and payment for all the work that he did, I'm going to give him Mitzrayim asher asu linu mashem inu mashem elokim. I'm going to give him the land of Egypt. That's what Hashem says. Bayom ahu atzmiach keren levei Yisrael l'cha etein pitchon pe b'tocham. And then, on that day, so what's Bayomahu Atzmiach Karen? Right? So the Radak says, don't think it means at the time when Mitzrayim gets captured, because that was the 27th year of Nebuchadnezzar, and there wasn't Tzmichat Karen for the Jews, they were just about to get destroyed. So Radak Rashi also says, and I don't know what this means, I never found that Tzmichat Karen, because the Jews were exiled 8 years before the Egyptians were exiled. The Egyptians lost in Nebuchadnezzar. So Rashi says he thinks the whole thing is talking about the 40 years when the Egyptians are going to come back. And whenever that comes out, and then he connects that connection, that timing, to when Belshazzar and Daniel have a very incident there, that in that year, the kings of Persia began to get stronger and they began to overthrow Babel, which would eventually lead to the Jewish people coming back, because the kings of Persia looked on us with much greater favor. That's Rashi's perspective of it. And the Radak quotes his father, who says something similar. He says that it was in the 50th year of Galut Bavel that Koresh was born. And Koresh is obviously the king, and he's called Mashiach in Yeshayahu, because he's the one who sends them back from exile. And then, so if it's going to be so much fun in the future, what is that? The Radak says they'll finally know. Right? And that's what Rashi says too. They'll finally see your Nevuot coming true. So this is way off in the future. And then they'll come to understand that you really were a Navi, that you really were somebody whose words they should have, it'll be too late in any real terms, but whose words they should have trusted, and they'll recognize that you are in fact a Navi
of truth, and that's when it's going to happen. So if you see that, then the Galut Mitzrayim coming back is going to happen fairly soon. And then you'd have to trace what Egypt's role was in the time of Bayit Sheni and things like that. But why is this connected to Nebuchadnezzar? So certainly it's true that he's the one who's actually going to exile Bavel, and maybe that's part of the point. But I think part of the point also is that Nebuchadnezzar, and here it's not clear that Nebuchadnezzar has to know that he's doing it. Nebuchadnezzar is serving as God's messenger without necessarily knowing it. So eventually they too will get destroyed, and the kings of Persia will be much more conscious of it, right? When Koresh sends the Jews back to, or gives the Jews permission to go back to Israel, it's consciously because, it's self-consciously because he understands that they are God's people and they live there and they need to go back there and all those kinds of things. So Nebuchadnezzar is not like that. So the fact that God speaks about Nebuchadnezzar as being his messenger in terms of Tsar and in terms of Mitzrayim is interesting, I think, because it shows that to be a God's messenger doesn't necessarily, and to earn reward, right? God is speaking here about properly rewarding him as has not yet happened. So to earn reward as God's messenger does not necessarily require here, in Yechezkel at least, doesn't require self-consciousness about it. There's a whole question in Halacha about how self-conscious you have to be about observing various mitzvot as a non-Jew in order for them to count as Shem Mitzvot Noach. So some say more self-conscious, that you do have to be very conscious of what you're doing. Some say not so much, that you don't have to be so self-conscious about what you're doing. But here, the issue of being a messenger of Hashem seems not to require so much self-consciousness. So if Mitzrayim had, for its own motives, helped the Jewish people out, or not abandoned them, or not been faithless, or not breached their peace treaty with the Jews, it's at least possible that they wouldn't have gotten punished in this way. But rather, instead of that, it's important to remember that their attitude is also part of the problem, right? Their attitude was that they were self-sufficient, they didn't need anything, they didn't need anybody, they didn't need Hashem, they had all of that, what they needed. So all of those underlying attitudes are what lead to their downfall and having so much problems. And it's not like, at least in this case, they would have had to say, oh, we completely recognize Hashem in order for them to avoid these kinds of punishments. Rather, as long as they had been able to say, and been able to keep to what they had agreed to, they might have avoided all of what's going on here. So in the first, and we'll see Mitzrayim a few more times in the coming Parakim, but in the first Parakim we'll see Mitzrayim, their central flaw is their self-confidence and their sense of themselves, as we've seen with Tsar, and they're serving as a false hope for the Jewish people. So they served as something that would lead the Jewish people astray, whether or not they actually meant it. And that leads to them having their downfall, needing to be re-educated. And the process of re-education is that they get sent into exile from their land for 40 years, and then they're going to get to come back. When that happens is unclear, but it seems to be right then, although we don't see that they come back, because Rabbi Akiva still seems to think of Binyamin Ger Mitzri, of this Egyptian convert, as not really being an Egyptian. So it's not clear how you weave that into the halacha, and that's why the Bahag perhaps felt that we don't follow Rabbi Akiva on that issue, and that in fact this Binyamin was an Egyptian, and therefore would have to observe the laws of Egyptian converts. He would have to have followed those rules and those requirements. That would be the Bahag's perspective. And so they do or don't come back. That's an issue that comes up here. And then once they come back, they will be continually lowly and subservient because of their need to learn, to be taught these lessons that we've been talking about. And that is where this parak leaves us off. We'll see more about Mitzrayim, about Egypt, in the coming days. Have a great day.